a priori likelihood of slow rolling inflation in lukewarm Bismarck. David.
Okay, thank you, and thank you for giving me the chance to give this talk. So what I want to tell you about today is some of the surprising results that we found from examining the a priori likelihood of slow roll inflation in loop quantum cosmology. This is work that's gone on here at Penn State between myself and Abhay. The paper's up on the archive. I've given the link there. And this builds off previous work done by Givens and Turok, particularly in the classical GR case, and some early LQC work by Germani, Nelson, and Sacalaria do. And I apologize as ever for butchering that name. Okay, so let's move on to the first slide. This is a brief introduction. So, loop quantum cosmology, what we see is the Big Bang singularity is replaced by a quantum bounce. And I should preface this by saying we're going to be working here in the flat k equal to zero Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker models. This bounce obviously has been seen in other models too now, in Bianchi models, in some Gaudi models, and various people have been working on this for quite a while. And this bounce seems to be being a fairly generic feature of loop quantum cosmology. Not only do we see a bounce, but we also agree with the classical case in the large scale limits, and so LQC seems to have some very nice features of a quantum cosmology. Now, this is a quantum theory of cosmology, so we're supposed to trust this at much higher energy scales than general relativity. In particular, we're not scared of entering the Planck regime. In contrast to, like, in general relativity, where we see that as energy scales increase, we quickly bring ourselves up to a singularity, that is, the energy scale gets larger and larger up until the point where we have a singularity. In loop quantum cosmology, as we get to higher and higher energy scales, we actually see that the dynamics of the system take us away from these scales again, and we undergo a bounce, and we return to a much lower density. However, what we'd like to do now is we'd like to be able to ask certain a priori questions. That is, certain questions that we ask without telling the system too much information, without putting any specific initial conditions in. My grammar check has been a bit overzealous there and a typo, but we'd like to ask a couple of questions, really. One is, does the theory allow for inflation? And the second is, if so, how likely is it that we see inflation? So it's not just got to allow inflation to happen, but we want to say that is it likely that we underwent enough inflation to answer the problems that inflation is supposed to answer? And I will go into some detail what that really means in a moment. Okay. What we're going to do is we're going to follow Laplace's principle of indifference in defining probabilities. Now, this is the way that we've always defined probabilities. It says that if we know nothing about events, we should assign an equal probability to every event. So if you have a die with six sides, you roll it, the odds of getting a four is 1 in 6. However, a rigorous implementation of this requires quite a bit of work when you look at, say, a Hamiltonian system. Exactly what this means to assign probabilities to events is quite difficult. It's very hard, for example, to make sense of this in terms of cosmology, to find probabilities, because in terms of statistics, we have one universe to observe. So to define probabilities is quite a difficult problem. In some sense, the principle of indifference is a natural one to apply in cosmology because it meshes very well with the Copernican principle. And the two can sort of be thought of together as basically saying, you're not special. There's nothing special about the universe we're in. We should say it's fairly generic. And we're not at a very special place within the universe itself. Okay, so we go to the next slide. We have an outline of what I'm going to talk about. First, I want to introduce inflation. I want to talk about why it was introduced in general relativity, what problems it's supposed to solve. Then, I'll go on to define probability and how we are going to use probability in this sense. And then, we're going to go through a warm-up problem, since the concepts are probably fairly unfamiliar in the way they're going to be written down at first. I want to apply this to a system that everybody hopefully can understand and show how we can use this to answer physical questions. Then, I'll go on to work on loop quantum cosmology. Now, we're going to be working with effective equations. We're going to work with effective equations all the way through the talk. And in this talk, we're going to really make the assumption that the full dynamics is well approximated by the effective equations. There have been work on the full dynamics done by Abai, Tomasz Pawlowski, and Pran Singh. They've seen that in some cases, in the cases they've examined, it seems that this is a valid statement to make. But the number of simulations, the amount of work that would be involved to do the full equations to get probabilities, the sheer volume of work, would actually take far longer than the amount of time that would be available in the universe. And therefore, we're going to be working in the effective equations all the way through this talk. Sorry, is there a question? Okay, well, we'll carry on. Let's see. Then we're going to talk about probability. In particular, how can one can define a probability in loop quantum cosmology? And I will tell you a bit about superinflation. This is a feature of loop quantum cosmology that's not in general relativity. It's actually a very robust feature, and it can have some quite profound effects on the dynamics of our system. Okay, so let's see. I was in the muddle, I guess, of apologizing for using effective equations. So let's see. The next step on the outline is, so we're going to talk about how we define probabilities on loop quantum cosmologies. And then I'm going to describe superinflation, which is a feature of loop quantum cosmology that's, you don't see this in the classical theory, but it is a robust feature of loop quantum cosmology, and it does seem to have some quite profound effects. Then, we're going to move on, we'll talk about a fixed model. In particular, I'm going to talk about a quadratic potential, this a physically motivated model. This is the sort of a simpler system. It's often used in classical GR with inflation. And I should give you a warning here that we're actually going to see some numbers. And in theoretical physics, we probably aren't used to this, but these are the kind of things that other physicists want us to give them. We're actually going to see some real, genuine, actual numbers with decimal points in them and everything. Then I'm going to tell you about the motion of the inflaton, how it moves within this potential, what the dynamics of space-time is, and get to some real probabilities of finding a certain number of e-foldings at the end of this. Finally, I'll give some conclusions, I'll give some concluding remarks and give some results, and some directions in which future work can be done. Okay, so next slide. This should be slide number 4 on inflation. Okay. So, a brief introduction to inflation. Inflation is the accelerated expansion of the early universe. Typically here, we're talking about the first 10 to the minus 35, 10 to the minus 36 seconds after the Big Bang or the Big Bounce. Okay, so like 10 to the 12 Planck times or something like that. What we see is this sort of this exponential expansion, which is typically fueled by this slow rolling of a scalar field down some potential. So what we want to see is the universe going through almost sort of an anti-de-Sitter type phase for a second there. Well, for a very, very short time there. This mechanism was brought in to solve certain physical problems. The idea was that inflation was going to solve for us the flatness problem, the horizon problem, the areas in the sky that seem not to have been in causal contact in the past somehow seem to have been connected. If we go through a large sudden expansion, we can bring regions that would not have been in causal contact into contact with one another. It's supposed to overcome the problem of magnetic monopoles, which would overcomplete and close the universe back in on itself. And in doing so, we are introducing problems of its own. Inflation seems to introduce this problem that needing, particularly this problem of needing fine-tuning. What seemed to happen in the classical case, and this was found by Gibbons and Turok, is that the probability of finding a number n of e-foldings is suppressed by e to the minus 3n. And since we typically need between 60 and 70, and the canonical number I'm going to use today is about 68, so since we need about 68 e-foldings, this number is suppressed by about 10 to the minus 89. I mean, this is an order of magnitude type thing, but there are going to be other variables involved in finding this probability. But since this factor of 10 to the minus 89 in there, it seems absolutely absurd that we should claim inflation happens by chance. Now, I should say that this is quite a controversial issue. Various people, particularly Linder and Buchanoff and Kaufman and all kinds of others, and Steinhardt, everyone has their favorite way of defining probabilities, and because people define things in different ways, they come up with different answers. People do things like bubble counting, they do measures based on the area of the certain space-time, the probability given a
you're at a point in space that you're inflating, et cetera, et cetera.
And here what we're going to do is we're actually going to take we're going to follow quite closely the methods that Givens and Cherov used because they pointed to the fact that inflation is incredibly unlikely in their system. Okay, so let's move to the next slide and talk about how we define probability. So what we want to do is we want to measure a priori probabilities. We want to measure probabilities without giving the system itself very much information. And this idea sort of comes from Givens and Turok is that we should do solution counting. Now, solution counting, what we want to do is we want to count the number of solutions to our Hamiltonian system, say, and just assign equal probability to each of them. However, in order to count the number of solutions, we need to have some natural measure in which we can just use to integrate and count up how many solutions we have. The natural measure that we use is the Liouville measure on phase space. However, if we want to count solutions, what we really need to do is pull this back onto a surface that every solution crosses exactly once, thus we cover every single solution using a natural measure. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the symplectic structure on this phase space and pull it back to a surface that every surface, which I call I, that every solution crosses exactly once, and we take this to form our measure. And we define in the usual way, this is just Bayesian statistics, and the exact same way we did in high school, the probability of an event X happening is the integral over the region in which this event happens of the measure divided by the total measure. Now, this all sounds very nice and good, but typically we have some problems in that the surface I is non-compact, and so we're going to need cutoffs or some kind of regularization scheme in order to actually make these integrals finite, and we're going to have to take limits in some way. Okay, next slide. So, let me talk about why we use a priori probabilities. Well, what we could do quite easily is introduce a probability distribution. Here I've called this F probability F of U, where U are some variables on this surface that we have. And we could insert this because we have a measure. Why not just multiply it by some function, and you can completely change all the set of probabilities you have. Well, in order to justify why we don't just multiply by any random function, F of U, we want to introduce the concept of information. Now, the information in a system, and to physicists, this function should hopefully look something like entropy. The amount of information in a probability distribution is given by the integral of f log f. Okay? And this is extremized by a uniform distribution. And so, what this says is the least amount of information you give a system is when you just assume that everything is equally likely. This, again, comes back to the principle of indifference. Thus, a priori probabilities, probabilities defined in this way, are useful when they're very high or very low. Because in these cases, you need to very, very finely tune F. You need a lot of information to justify some probability distribution that makes these events now likely or unlikely. So this would put an incredibly heavy burden on any theory to overcome a very high or very low a priori probability. Okay, and I'll pause here and see if anyone has any questions about this. Okay, so I'm going to assume by the silence that you've either all hung up or there are no questions. So let's move on to the next slide. So now what we're going to do is work through a warm-up problem so everyone can see how this works in practice. What we're going to look at is an equatorial orbit of a planet around the sun, where I've picked all the masses to be equal to 1 and done everything so that life turns out simple in terms of algebra. What we have here is a 4D Hamiltonian system. We have a four-dimensional phase space, the radial coordinate and momentum, the angular coordinate and momentum. Since angular momentum is fixed, we're going to fix a plane perpendicular to angular momentum, in which case we can just simplify the system. And what we're going to do is fix the total energy of the system. We're going to have a bounded orbit, so the energy is negative. And this leads us to a single constraint. We have a symplectic structure, which is given as omega here. And since each orbit crosses the coordinate phi equals 0 exactly once, we can solve our constraint and pull back to this slice to form a measure on this surface I. And the measure is given by omega here. And the ranges of the, so the definition of this surface I is given at the very bottom of the slide. Okay, let's move on to the next slide. So now we can find the total measure. Turns out to be finite. Notice that capital E is negative, so this is just a real number. And we can now take this probability measure and apply it to a physical problem. In particular, we can apply it to the question of eccentricity. We want to know, for example, the region of phase space for which we have some eccentricity greater than E0, okay? So if we have our space of solutions to our Hamiltonian system, we have planets orbiting the sun, how likely is it that given a random bounded orbit that we have a given eccentricity for this planet? And so here I have defined the surface I, surface A, within this surface I, on which we have an eccentricity greater than this E0. And this is defined here. And so we find that the probability we get an eccentricity greater than E0 is just given by the root 1 minus E0 squared. So this does, hopefully, exactly what we want it to. Eccentricity is bounded between 0 and 1 for these bounded orbits. And you notice that it goes to 1 for equal E0 is 0. It goes to 0 for E0 is 1. And it does all kinds of nice things in between. Okay, so let's move on to the next slide. So in doing this, it seems to raise certain interpretational issues. First, it seems that we seem to be saying that almost circular orbits are very unlikely. But our solar system, as we go and look at it, is populated by almost circular orbits. So are we therefore forced to say that our solar system is unlikely? Am I counteracting the Copernican principle somehow? Let's move to the next slide. Well, the answer to this is, unsurprisingly, no. You have to consider the question that we've asked. And the question is, if I randomly distribute these planets in phase space, what is the probability that they have a certain given eccentricity? However, the orbits we have is actually picked out by other physics. There's a whole planetary formation going on. We have a sun, it's gas, and these planets agglomerate, and they form into solid rocks and start orbiting in the system. And so what this really tells us, and what I want this to inform you of, is that if we have an event that seems to have a low probability, what this really means is a heavy burden on the physical model to explain why this event happens. In particular here, we see there's a heavy burden on planetary physics to explain why we get almost circular orbits. And this is a view taken by Gibbons and Turok. This is the reasoning they give for saying that, okay, since there was a very low a priori probability of inflation, this doesn't mean inflation didn't happen. It just means you have to come up with much more information. You have to come up with a very good reason for why you want to say inflation happened in the first place. Okay, I'm going to pause here and see if there are any questions about this. Is anyone still with us?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, so not just me. Great, so let's move on to the next slide, which is about loop quantum cosmology. So as I said before, we're going to work from the effective Hamiltonian for loop quantum cosmology. There's a whole bunch of people who've worked on this, and I'm sorry if I've left your name out here. It's nothing personal. There's just a whole lot of names I could write down. There is a four-dimensional phase space for our system. We have a scalar field and its momentum, the volume of space, and its conjugate momentum. And we have one constraint, our Hamiltonian constraint, which is given here. In this, lambda is the area gap, so the minimum eigenvalue, minimum non-zero eigenvalue, I should say, the area operator, and gamma is the inversity parameter. We get classical physics back by taking the limit that lambda goes to zero, and if you can do this, and you just recover classical GR equations of motion. We have the equations of motion for our system given slightly lower down on this slide, and there are a couple of things that I want you to notice about this. First is that B is a monotonic non-increasing variable. In fact, if we explicitly remove the situation where B of phi is the critical density for all phi, that is sort of the anti-de Sitter solutions, then on any open interval in time, B is decreasing. So we have this monotonic variable B.
The second is that the system has a symmetry under the rescaling of the volume and the scalar field momentum by the same factor. Okay, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Also note that the zero volume state is decoupled from the system. The only way to get to volume equal to zero is to have it be zero for all time. Okay, let's move to the next slide. And again, I'm trying to go fast to get through this in time, though. So this system itself has this useful symmetry that we can rescale the scalar field momentum and volume by the same amount without changing the physics. So under this transformation, we find that the scalar field, the motion of the scalar field, that the space-time physics itself is unchanged. And what happens is that the volume just gets rescaled. The reason for this is that we need extra structure in the flat case because there's no explicit length scale here. So in cake with zero cosmology, we have to introduce this fiducial cell, this fiducial length scale. And what could happen is if I'd chosen one length scale, one fiducial cell, and someone had chosen some other fiducial cell, we should both get the same space-time physics. The physics should know nothing about the extra structure we had to bring in just to simply define phase space well. And so there should be a symmetry that we can consider as just rescaling the fiducial cell. Or we could also consider this as sort of a symmetry between solutions that have different volumes at a given time, but with one fixed fiducial cell. Either way, we can sort of see that this is just a symmetry of our system. And we can view this symmetry in a sense as gauge. Okay, so let's move on to the next slide. So now I'm going to start talking about loop quantum cosmology in earnest, and we're going to talk about some of the new features of loop quantum cosmology, which are key to this analysis. So there are two new key features of LQC which we're going to use. First is that we have a unique bounce point at b equals pi over 2 lambda. Now recall that b is monotonic. It's monotonic non-increasing. In fact, really, it's almost monotonic decreasing. And therefore, every solution will go through this one unique bounce point. Okay? Second is that we have superinflation. And superinflation is defined as the Hubble parameter increasing. So in order to agree with general relativity, both on the contracting branch in the distant past and on an expanding branch in the distant future, this has to happen. You see, in general relativity, the Hubble parameter is monotonically decreasing. However, in loop quantum cosmology, we go through a bounce at which the Hubble parameter is zero. And so unless we want it to be zero for all time, at some stage it's got to increase. And so this Hubble has to go up to some large value and start coming back down in order to agree with solutions of general relativity. And from the equations of motion we gave, we can see the evolution of the Hubble parameter here. And notice that this Hubble has this sine factor in it. This is why it's the Hubble parameter is no longer monotonic. Okay, it actually oscillates with B. And again, as I said, before the bounce, the Hubble is negative. After it's positive, and therefore we've got to have some stage at which it's increasing. Hopefully that's pretty obvious. Mathematicians have sort of theorems to prove this kind of thing, but as a physicist, I think it's okay to say it goes from negative to positive, therefore it goes through zero and it's increasing. Okay, so again, as I said earlier, all solutions bounce at some unique value. Therefore, we're going to take our gauge fixed 2D surface, this I, on which we're going to count the solutions and assign probabilities. We're going to take the solution, we're going to take the surface to be at the bounce point, that is, that B equals pi over 2 lambda, or the Hubble parameter equal to zero. Also, we're going to satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint, so I've fixed one variable, I've got one constraint fixed, and so I'm going to reduce this four-dimensional phase space to being a space on two variables. Now, notice that we're putting no requirements here on space-time in the distant past, satisfying it, being in any state or satisfying any set of equations or anything. We're just picking a surface that counts every single solution. We could have done this for any value of b, really, but, I mean, for technical reasons, to make things easiest, because we want to count the number of e-foldings to the future of the bounce, we're going to do this at the bounce point itself. Okay, next slide. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the bounce point. So recall we have fixed this 2D surface for counting solutions. Our bounce point is a non-prejudiced point. That is, we've picked the point that every solution goes through. There's nothing special about solutions that bounce since everyone does it. And again, as I said, we could do this for any b equals constant surface. It's only really for reasons of simplicity in terms of counting the amount of e foldings that happen that we're going to take this to be the bounce point. So this surface, this 2D surface, contains every solution, but it is a non-compact surface, okay? We have two directions on the surface. We have the value of the scalar field, and we have the volume at the bounce point. And the volume at the bounce point is completely unbounded. It can take any value. So following the method that I described above to form a measure, what we're going to do is pull back our symplectic structure onto this 2D surface, parameterized by nu and phi, our volume and value of the scalar field, and from this we form our measure. Now notice this is the nu wedge d phi with some function in front of it, and this function is completely independent of nu, as we would hope it would be, because physics should know nothing about the size of the fiducial cell. And what I want you to recall is that we're going to look for the fractional volume of the surface that leads to a sufficient amount of inflation, that leads to the 68 e-foldings that are so necessary for answering our physical problems. Okay, next slide. Okay, so now let me tell you about how we're going to calculate probabilities in this case. So recall the way we've defined the way calculating probabilities is we want to find the number of solutions that have this property A and divide by the total number of solutions. And also recall that the physics is invariant under this rescaling of the volume. Okay? So what we want to say is that this integral over this 2D surface is an integral over volume and value of the scalar field. But the integral over the volume is really just to be considered as gauge. We could do this in a couple of ways. I mean, remember this function is independent of nu, and so the integral over nu would just contribute a number. Now, this number is technically infinite, but we can erase this by in a couple of ways. First, we could do this by taking the integral from nu is 0 to some finite cutoff and taking the ratio, and since this number appears in both numerator and denominator, these two things cancel, and so we can ignore it. Or we can do this by some sort of group averaging type procedure under the action of this rescaling. Anyway, what we end up with is the fact that physical questions depend only on the value that the scalar field takes at the bounce point. And we end up with a well-defined probability measure, this integral given at the bottom of this slide. And this is exactly the method described by Givens and Turok, although they arrived at it a different way. What they do is they talk about space-times with a given curvature and then take the limit as curvature goes to zero. Okay, and so I'm going to stop here and see if questions. Yes, please.
Is the potential bounded from above?
The potential has to be bounded from above because every solution bounces at rho critical. And so the critical density bounds the potential from above, yes. In fact, this square root, if you're worried about the square root becoming negative or something, this is actually forced to have real solutions by the Hamiltonian constraint. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, great. So let's move on to the next slide, unless there are any more questions. Okay, so let me tell you about the robust superinflation in loop quantum cosmology. So in LQC, we do see this phase of superinflation. It begins at the bounce point, and it ends at b is pi over 4 lambda, and the Hubble achieves its maximum value. Now, originally, it was thought that this could entirely replace inflation, because we have this superinflation, we do have this expansion of the universe, and this might happen even without a potential. But unfortunately, without a potential in there, the amount of superinflation you get, the volume only increases by a factor of root 2, so you get log root 2 e-foldings of inflation. And so what we actually find is that the amount of superinflation we get in the system is determined by two things. One is the shape of the potential itself, and the second is the value of the scalar field during this phase. Now, this superinflation ends at the Hubble achieving its universal maximum, which is about 0.93, and this point is universal, okay? So the Hubble, it goes to its absolute maximum of 0.93 on every solution, and obviously because it's at its maximum, H dot is zero. And these are good conditions for starting slow roll inflation, okay? Recall that what we wanted was a Hubble parameter that was fairly large, and was barely evolving. And this is exactly what we've got. So if you move to the next slide, I've got a little graph of superinflation and loop quantum cosmology. What we see here, and on the graph that I've drawn here, time runs counterclockwise. So we start on the axis at the bottom, the x-axis high up, with the Hubble parameter equal to zero and increasing. We see that all the points are filtered through the, all the trajectories are filtered through this one point on the graph where the Hubble is about 0.93 and Hubble dot is zero, no matter where we start, and then we come back down again. Okay? So this has all happened in the deep Planck regime. Remember, B is pi over 4 lambda, so we're well in the Planck regime. We're far, far away from classical physics here. And again, note that there is this universal maximum, the Hubble of 0.93, say, for all loop quantum cosmologies. So this is a feature of loop quantum cosmology that we don't normally talk about very much, but what we see is that the Hubble parameter is both bounded from above and it achieves its bound. Okay.
What is the horizontal axis here?
The horizontal axis is the Hubble rate, the rate of change of the Hubble parameter.
So how is one to interpret this graph then?
So this graph is for various different simulations, various different initial conditions with, well, what I've done here is I fixed one potential, but you can put any potential you like in it. And what I want to show you from this graph is that no matter where we start, we always start on this horizontal axis, the Hubble equals to zero, that's the bound point. No matter where we start on this graph, we're always forced through this one point at the top left-hand corner where the Hubble hits its maximum and starts to come back down again.
So this is like a sort of phase-phase plot, quote unquote.
Yeah, this is like a phase-phase plot. It's not, I mean, typically in general relativity, you can use the Hubble and Hubble H and H dot as a good set of coordinates because the Hubble is monotonic. However, in loop quantum cosmology, you can't really do this because the Hubble is not. It's multi-valued for in time. And so what this is really saying is that before we hook up to classical physics, we're forced through this one universal point in loop quantum cosmology.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so any more questions about this? Okay, so let's move on to the next slide. And so what I should say is up until this point, we've used a very generic potential, just d of phi could be anything so long as it's bounded above by the critical density and below by zero. Now what we're going to do is we're going to introduce a physically motivated potential. This is a quadratic potential. This is the kind typically used by cosmologists when they want to explain inflation. It's the simplest one. The results I'm going to give you are probably fairly generic in changing the potential itself, but again, we're just going to look at the simplest case here. So what we want to do is we want to see a situation in which we have slow roll inflation. We want to see how likely this is. So what we say is this is approximated by a constant value of the Hubble, i.e. h dot over h squared is much less than 1. So again, we've introduced this quadratic potential, and we see that the inflaton motion actually looks a lot like one of these damped harmonic oscillators that we all spent so long in high school learning about. Now notice this isn't exactly a damped harmonic oscillator because the Hubble value, the Hubble parameter does evolve in time. However, during the slow roll inflation, this Hubble should be approximately constant, and therefore we can treat it almost as a damped harmonic oscillator. We're going to take a physically motivated inflaton mass. We'll take 6 times 10 to the minus 7 Planck masses. This comes from the Kobe normalization of the CMB spectrum. And again, we have this damping parameter, zeta, which is the Hubble over 2m. Now notice the Hubble achieves this maximum of 0.93. The mass is 6 times 10 to the minus 7. And so at some stage, this is going to be a massively, massively overdamped system. Okay? If a damping parameter is bigger than 1, we call this overdamped, and this is something of order 10 to the 14. And so this is a hugely overdamped harmonic oscillator. It's not typically going to oscillate back and forth about a minimum. It's really what we're going to see is some sort of exponential decay. Okay, let's move to the next slide. We'll talk about the dynamics of the universe. So to understand the dynamics of the system, what we're going to do is split it up into 3 cases at the bounce point. We're going to base this on the physically, this is going to be based on the distribution of the energy in the harmonic oscillator at the bounds. Remember that we've got to hit the critical density, the energy equals, the energy density is the critical density of the bounds, and so this has to be somehow spread out between the kinetic and potential terms of the inflaton. So we're going to look at three different cases. This just makes the analysis easier. First, we're going to look at potential domination, that is where the potential energy outweighs the kinetic energy. Then we're going to look at small kinetic domination, that is where the obviously the kinetic energy outweighs the potential, but the potential is still significantly larger than zero. And then we'll look at the extreme kinetic case. This is where the potential is almost zero. Almost all the energy is in the kinetic energy. Okay, notice that all these cases are expressed simply in terms of the value of the scalar field at the bounce point. And to simplify the algebra, we're going to define F, this fraction, to be the potential energy divided by the critical density. So F lies somewhere between 0 and 1. It just describes how the energy is distributed in this oscillator. Okay, next slide. So first, this is the case of potential domination. This is F larger than a half. So what we see here is a very long phase of superinflation. We see that slow roll itself actually begins during superinflation. Now, this is completely unachievable with classical physics. To understand this, we really have to be in the superinflation regime, which is a completely LQC effect. This is just not there in GR. And so to analyze anything with F larger than a half, we really absolutely need to be in LQC. In fact, for most cases, we need to use the LQC equations anyway, but particularly in this case, it becomes absolutely apparent that you have to have some sort of quantum cosmology to analyze this. And so what happens is we start with the inflaton, say, rolling up its potential. It reaches some turnaround point and starts to slowly roll back down, still during superinflation. And so the universe will undergo this long superexponential phase. Now, we undergo an exponential expansion if the Hubble were constant, but in this case, the Hubble is actually increasing. And so when you see the number of e-folds against time that I have plotted here, e-folds is like the log of the volume, we see that there's a very, very slight positive curve. This graph curves very, very slightly away from the x-axis here. And so what we see is a very large amount of superinflation. If you look at the amount of twice time this lasts, this isn't actually very long I've got here, and already we've achieved well over the 68 e-foldings that we need. And eventually this superinflation is followed by a long inflation phase. This isn't actually depicted here because in order to get there, this graph would have to be enormous. Okay, let's move to the next slide. Here we look at kinetic domination. I realize there's a typo here. This should say 10 to the minus 10 is less than F, is less than a half. Here what we see is a very short length of superinflation. In fact, in the graph here, you can almost not see it, but the very, very bottom left pixel where the graph moves away from zero very quickly, this is the superinflation phase. It's very short-lived. Okay? Then what happens is the inflaton reaches its maximum, it turns around and comes back down, and we see a very long phase of slow-roll inflation. Here again, we see this sort of almost exponential expansion. Again, this graph is slightly curving towards the x-axis. That is, we have an almost exponential expansion, almost a zeta phase, if you like. And we see that outside of this extreme kinetic domination, we always achieve more than 68 e-foldings. Okay? And here, again, I've just given a typical graph of what's going on here. We see that the number of e-foldings, the rate of change, the log of the volume against time, is increasing at an almost linear rate, so we have an almost exponential expansion of the universe. Okay, next slide. And then we have the final case in which we see extreme kinetic domination. Now here, the inflaton is starting very near the minimum of its potential, and it rolls up to some small value and begins to slowly roll down. And again, at the very start of this graph, you see a very, very short period of superinflation. That's where the number of e-foldings jumps from 0 to close to 5 here. Okay, in a very, very short length of time. And then we see what seems to be the starting of a slow roll inflation, but it doesn't actually last all that long, and we quickly see that we curve away from this straight line behavior. We actually are no longer in slow roll. Okay.
Now, what I want you to notice about this graph as well is that on the scale, on the x-axis in Planck time, this now takes 10 to the 7 Planck time as opposed to 10 or 100 of the last couple of graphs. So this lasts a lot, lot longer than just the superinflation-dominated phases. Okay? Also, this is a new thing as well in the extreme kinetic case. We see that there's an absolute minimum of about 7 e-foldings total of superinflation and regular inflation. Okay, so you can do it. You can sort of spread your initial parameters across the entire space and see what the number of e-foldings you get at the absolute minimum is. And this is about 7, which would have an incredibly low probability, according to Gibbons and Turok, in classical cases. This would be something like 10 to the minus 6. The suppression factor on this would make it one part in a million. However, for loop quantum cosmology, this is an absolute minimum, so you have 100% chance that you get more than at least, I think it's more than 6.8 e-foldings of inflation. Okay, next slide. And so on this slide, I have sort of a cartoon summary of the dynamics. Don't take the numbers on this slide at all seriously, because what I've done here is I've increased the mass rather a lot so that we can get everything in one graph. What we see is we start with a universe pre-bound that's collapsing. It undergoes some deflationary phase. We have a bounce. We have a period of superinflation. That's the really sharp curve away from the bounce point. Then we see a long, slow roll inflationary phase. And this is sort of the typical dynamics that we're going to see here. Okay, here I should ask if there are any questions about the dynamics, or should we move on?
I have a question.
Yes.
So, I have a confusion regarding your case one.
Okay. The potential domination?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, so let us say the potential is quite dominant over the kinetics now.
Yes.
So, in that case, one can show from the modified Friedman equation that it just resembles like the classical Friedman equation. Like, one just gets rescaling of G, in a sense, because the potential is dominant over phi dot square.
Okay.
So, if that is the case, then I'm confused that how does slow roll begin during superinflation? Because with the superinflation, it means that the Hubble rate has rate varies a lot. Whereas during the slow roll inflation, we require that the potential is pretty much flat. And since the only term which is contributing is the potential of tensorons, I find it difficult to see like how slow roll inflation can start within a superinflationary phase when potential is dominant.
Okay, so when the potential is dominant, what slow roll? I mean, this inflaton is moving up the potential, let's say. Okay, and because the potential is very large, because the kinetic term is very small, we have a lot of friction. This frictional term coming from the Hubble parameter is very large. And so what we're actually going to see is the actual motion of the inflaton is massively damped by this friction.
That is true, but if you require slow roll, if the potential has to be very flat, how does your Hubble vary a lot, which will be the requirement in the superinflation?
The superinflation is not that the Hubble vary a lot. I mean, it just simply is that it is increasing. I mean, it can be increasing, but incredibly slowly.
So this is the phase in which immediately after the bounce, the Hubble varies, but it varies very slowly.
Yes.
Okay.
So, I mean, what happens is if you look at the equation for H dot, say, there is a cosine lambda b, cosine 2 lambda b phi dot squared. I haven't written this down anywhere, so you probably can't see it here. But when you look at the dynamics, basically there's a term in terms of b, and there's a term in terms of phi dot squared for the evolution of the Hubble parameter. Normally, in GR, it's just phi dot squared. However, in loop quantum cosmology, we get this correction, this lambda correction. And so because we are in potential domination, the phi dot term is very, very small. And so the Hubble is actually very, very slowly evolving.
Okay.
Okay. Let's move on, and we move to the next slide, which would be slide 24, about the probability distribution. And I promise I'll finish very soon, because we're about out of time. So, since we have a measure, we can form our probability distribution on this F, okay? So remember, we have this measure on the
values of the scalar field. We can just transform this into, for reasons of brevity here, I've transformed this into f. You can just leave it in terms of the value of the scalar field if you like. And we find that for f is larger than 10 to the minus 10, we definitely get more than 68 e-foldings. This number of e-foldings we get is almost, it just increases with f increasing. And so what we can ask is, what is the probability that f is larger than 10 to the minus 10? Well, we just have a way of calculating that now. And so we find that this probability is about 0.9999, and the nines actually go on for a little while after that. And so we found exactly what we wanted, an incredibly high a priori likelihood of inflation. And so what this means now is sort of the analysis of Gibbons and Turok entirely gets inverted. Now you would have to come up with a very, very heavy burden on any physical theory to explain why inflation didn't happen, given that you have this implaton and a potential and so on. Okay, next slide. So here I want to just say a few
very... David?
Yes.
I have a question.
Yes.
Good on you.
Hi.
Okay, so question is, what determines the number 68 here? But could it be 120 probability field 0.999?
Yes. So, I just picked the number 68 because that was the minimum amount of e-foldings required to address the monopole problem. But you could pick a much higher value, and again, you don't increase f. You'd have to increase, the number of e-foldings goes, it is a function of f, but, the function is quite complicated. But, you still have quite a high probability of having a lot more than 68 e-foldings if inflation. In fact, in Linda's analysis of classical GR, he sees things like something like 10 to the 12 e-foldings of inflation is perfectly acceptable in the classical case.
Okay, so my confusion is that having a probability of having infinitely large inflation is in fact the highest, is that correct?
No. There is an absolute maximum number of e-foldings of inflation you could ever get from loop quantum cosmology. Because the number of e-foldings is not—it's not a simple function of f. It is increasing, but it's not. It has an absolute maximum. The reason for this is that to get an absolute maximum number of e-folds, what you really want to do is have as much superinflation as possible. So you want to start the implaton at the absolute top of its potential at the bounds. But by the time the inflaton gets all the way down to the very bottom of its potential, you must stop inflation, because now the slow roll approximation is no longer valid. And so no matter how high you start the inflaton up its potential, eventually it is going to decay to small values.
My question is, where does that load maximum? Is that 10,000 e-folding?
No. Actually, to understand what the absolute maximum is, this is beyond the simulations I can currently do, but it is probably at least 10 to the 13. Okay, so let's move on to the slide 25, which is about the robustness of the system. First, what I want to say is you can decrease the mass. The results are about the same. You can decrease it by a couple of order of magnitudes. You still get a larger than 99% chance of having more than 68 e-foldings. And you can increase the mass a couple of order of magnitudes. Again, it doesn't affect things. So even if you don't want to believe the mass of the implaton that I've used, you can say that this is robust under a change of an order of magnitude or so, and cosmologists have put much better bounds on it than that. And so hopefully this result is pretty robust in itself. Likewise, and this is sort of a work in progress, but you can change the form of the potential. You can use exponential potentials, quartic potentials, insert your favorite potential here. And it doesn't seem to make actually that much of a difference so long as you have some potential function. You have to pick a pretty pathological potential to stop this from happening. If you picked one with multiple minima, you could have something strange happen, but so long as it's bounded from below by zero, and it's not to be bounded above, obviously, by the critical density, because with quantum cosmology won't let you go above that. Okay. So, next slide, come to some conclusions. First, we can now define a measure of probability like Gibbons and Turok did, and we can do it in loop quantum cosmology. The key result of this is that inflation now has a very high a priori likelihood. That means the burden of any proof, I think, is now on someone to say why inflation wouldn't happen. given that you have this implicit on the field.
Some key features of loop quantum cosmology were necessary. We had to be willing to go to high densities. We had to be willing to go outside the GR regime. We had to see that superinflation set up the conditions for this, for example. So we needed physics close to the Planck scale. And the bounce point was necessary. Well, at least it was highly useful to give us a good place at which to start things going. We wanted to find how many defaults happen after the bounce, and so starting at the bounce point was very useful for us. As I said, superinflation seems to set up the conditions. It has a very important effect. Now, what I want you to note, again, I said this before, but I really want to stress this, is that we didn't put any specific conditions. We didn't consider any special set of solutions in the distant past on the pre-bounce branch. We just said, okay, let's set the system up. Let's count every single solution that we can find. And for convenience, we're going to count them all as they go through the bounce point. Okay? All right, so let's move to the next slide, which is just work I want to do. So future work to do on this, we want to apply this to more complicated systems. Particularly, I want to go through a whole bunch of potentials, you know, Higgs potential, quartic potential, two-field potentials, et cetera, et cetera. Again, I use the most simple one. I use the quadratic potential because, you know, it's the easiest one to do to begin with, but I'd love to do this for more complicated systems. Yes?
Can I just ask a question about the issue of probabilities you discussed on the previous slide?
Sure.
So is it fair to say that you've shown that the probability of inflation, of more than 60 defaults of inflation, is high, assuming that the field is homogeneous through the bounce?
Yes.
That the field is homogeneous at the bounce point and sort of through the bounce so that you could use these homogeneous equations?
Yes.
I might have thought that the hard thing to prove would be that there was a high probability that would happen. I mean,
right, absolutely, yes. I mean, I'm in no way saying that I have shown that cosmologies tend to be homogeneous through a bounce. I mean, you have to do some type of BKL type analysis or something clever to get there. What I've done is I've made the assumption that we're in an FRW cosmology. And what I hope to have shown is that there's a high probability of inflation within these homogeneous isotropic solutions.
I guess you're saying that's the same assumption that Turok and Gibbons made anyway.
Yeah, that's exactly the same assumption. I mean, we're just doing the very simplest cosmologies here. We certainly aren't including any inhomogeneities.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. And so back to the last thing is I would like to do, actually, anisotropic and understand what superinflation does in homogeneous cosmology. So what we've been seeing is in the early models of Bianchi cosmologies, the anisotropic models, is that the bounce is not a unique point anymore. We have bounces in different directions at different times. And so perhaps we have to ask questions about what it means to have e-foldings in different sort of directions and so on, and really understand how we can translate this analysis to the much more complicated systems that you were talking about. Okay, and that's everything I had to say, and thank you for bearing with me through the technical difficulties.
I have a question.
Yes.
As far as I understand, you produce the necessary from the ones determined by the COBE normalization. Is that right?
Yes. I'm just taking the mass that I think Linda gives in a paper.
Okay. So what would it happen if you were to change this mass? In other words, can we say that this result is fine-tuned because you fixed one of your parameters from the very beginning?
No. Actually, if you look at the robustness slide that I gave, I think that's like slide 25, I actually say that you can increase or decrease this mass by a couple of orders of magnitude, and you get the same results.
Okay, sorry.
No, that's fine.
More questions?
Yes, I have a question. Hi, David.
Hi.
There are some claims of people like Glenn Starkman that there's no power above a certain angle in the sky. I think it's 60 degrees or something like that. It's been suggested that maybe there are, you know, sort of precisely 62 e-foldings, and after that there's no power generated. If that, I mean, that's is very controversial, but if that were established, would you be willing to say that loop quantum cosmology was ruled out as a description of the past?
Okay, I would not be willing to say that that loop quantum cosmology itself was ruled out, no, because what I've done here is I've given a very specific potential for an implicon. I mean, what I've done is I've had LTC and introduced this extra structure. What I would be willing to say is that a quadratic potential of this form, if you say, is incredibly unlikely. You'd have to come up with some, as I say, it would be a very heavy burden on any theory to say why you got exactly 62 or something.
Okay, thank you.
So, can I say something here?
Go ahead.
I think the important point that David made in the very beginning is really crucial here. I mean, I think that what really happens in any realistic situation, when you give a lot more physical input, the only value of a priori probability is qualitative value, that is to say, when it says that something is almost certainly going to happen or all not going to happen. I think anything like, you know, precisely how many foldings occurred, et cetera, that would need much more input, and therefore a flat a priori probability distribution that is used in such analysis really does not shed much light on that. So therefore, loop quantum cosmology by itself is not being used here. I think what is being used here is loop quantum cosmology together with this idea of calculating a priori probabilities. And one just small correction to what, a historical correction to what David said, was that this idea is actually very, very old, right? I mean, it goes back in the 18th. I mean, several people have it. I think Hawking and Page and Gibbons and several other people wrote the paper. So I think this idea has been around since the 18th. That one might be able to calculate a priori probability, and that may have this limited use.
Mm-hmm. More questions? So I have a question. If we go back to that quote-unquote phase-based plot we were talking about,
yeah.
Does one see there the foldings or just the units wrong?
No, you can't see the foldings in this plot at all.
You don't have a similar plot like this where you see, oh yeah, all the solutions are defolding in this area of phase space or something like that.
I could produce such a plot, but no, I don't have it here largely because what would actually happen here is you'd see that for the lower values, you'd see a huge number more e-foldings than in the large values, even in a log-log plot.
Okay.
Basically, what we're going to have to do is to really divide the problem into the three parts that David mentioned, so the potential energy dimension and the other dimension. Because a lot of stuff happens during superinflation in the potential dominated era. And therefore that for potential dominated analysis, you have to blow up that part of the phase space, basically. And then for the kinetic dominated phase space, you have to blow up what happens for part of the phase space after the end of superinflation. So one could do this in several plots, but I think one plot would be difficult to do.
Yeah, it's also particularly different because the time scales involved are just orders of magnitude different.
Exactly. I was making exactly that point.
Any more questions?
I have a small question. So, some years ago, it was shown that if one considers LTC effective dynamics and puts the massive scalar field, and one looks at the phase space trajectory, one gets slow roll as an attractor of the dynamics. And I think similar results holds for the slow roll inflation in classical GR. So I'm slightly, I know the answer, perhaps the answer which one gets from studying the attractors is incomplete compared to what the analysis given the Turok did and what you did. But can you comment something on this, that in what sense it is incomplete?
Let's see. So, what you want to say is that slow roll is an attractor of the dynamics, therefore, I mean, is that your, is your claim, therefore, that that makes slow roll a likely outcome?
Yeah. So since slow roll, it is known to be an attractor of dynamics post-bump in LQC, why one could not have guessed that you will get a very positive result?
Go ahead.
Because it's also true without LQC, right?
No. But without LQC, you may say that we don't know the equations for GR at very high curvature.
So obviously, just assume it's GR.
But in GR, like one starts with an inflaton, but the usual argument for the chaotic inflation is that we may start with V, which is of the order of MP4, or even of, even if it's smaller, like you get sufficient V folding. But in LQC, even if, whatever are the conditions pre-bound, if you go through the bound, one can show the slow roll is an attractor.
Well, I think it's really that argument that Kirovsky given here in this paper against the idea that just because something is an attractor doesn't really say that the probability of inflation is high. And the reason is because that attractor, I mean, you don't know what the volume of the space is or what the that really corresponds to the attracting cyclic space. And if you could measure the trajectories which were not attracted or not attracted to taking the path, then, I mean, it's a different question. In other words, I'm agreeing completely that if there is an attractor phenomenon, it always suggests that something is happening. But if you want to calculate something like a priori probability, I don't know how to calculate it by looking at something that is attractive.
Yeah, okay, I have another small comment. So I think like one, there are two things which are heavily used in this analysis, and I'm just trying to filter out LQC part. So the two things are, first of all, there is a superinflation,
yes,
which will occur generically whenever we have a bouncing cosmology.
Yeah, completely agree, yeah.
And the second thing which is heavily used is that there is a supremum on the space-time curvature, which is in the form of rho critical.
Yes.
So, can you comment, or have you guys thought on that, suppose one writes an action in which one adds higher order curvature terms, for example, what, for example, Mukhanov or Brandenburger were suggesting in early 90s, and one obtains a non-singular cosmology, which is bouncing, and one couples inflation with that, as you guys have done, then one will get a similar answer?
Well, there's not just the fact that we have superinflation, but superinflation in loop quantum cosmology seems to really set the scene for slow roll inflation. It's not just that we superinflate, it's that we go to a very high value of the Hubble with h dot equal to zero. So, I mean, we could superinflate, but we could not superinflate enough, or we could superinflate, or and different trajectories could superinflate to different Hubbles if we had a different form of cosmology. So, ahead of time, I couldn't do that kind of analysis. I couldn't say that we'd necessarily always hit this same universal maximum. In fact, it came as a shock to me that there was a universal maximum for Hubble.
Okay.
And basically, the phase space in this higher derivative series is much different. It is much higher dimension, right? Because you cannot measure phase
space. But the higher derivative series is just an example. So what I want to ask is that suppose we are given a non-singular cosmology, irrespective of LQC, and which is bouncing, so that means superinflation will be present. I don't know how small or big it is. And the theory which has a universal bound on space-time curvature.
I think it is true that at the end of superinflation, the Hubble factor has reached its maximum value. Because what we need is somehow this higher value of Hubble and more value of H-star. If this were achieved, then it is likely.
I think it will be achieved quite generally. The difficult thing is to construct such a model, and LQC is one example for that. But I think like if you have a non-singular bouncing cosmology, you will get the conditions which you get in LQC.
Right. I mean,
I'm not sure. I mean, of course, I should have to design it at the end of the presentation. But at that stage, if in fact Hubble parameter has its maximum value, it's not obvious to me. But if you say it's true, then I can understand. I'd like to understand it better.
Well, Abhay, I think
two factors coming together are not obvious.
I think that isn't the definition of the end of inflation H dot equal to zero, because H dot has been positive and then it hits zero. So the Hubble has to hit a maximum there. I mean, the real question is how big this maximum is.
No, I think even that is hard to say. Okay, we can talk a little bit more about that, because you are assuming that that means that then after this H must decrease, then it is, what you're saying is true.
Right, because otherwise you'd hook up to sort of an anti-suicide solution or something.
Right. And although also other possibilities in which, you know, the maximum value of the parameter may not be reached here, but may be reached in the prior phase somewhere, where I don't know. I think one just says, well, I just have a general cosmology, and I don't know why certain things must happen. But if, in fact, if you have a general cosmology, in which there is a bound, there is actually a performance curvature, and therefore on density, and that the Hubble parameter actually, then the superimposition fails, and at the end of the Hubble parameter, at the end of the superimposition fails, it is true that the Hubble parameter has its absolute maximum, then all those things would be, then I think it is likely that there will be, that inflation would be very powerful.
Another question along these lines is, so Parham brought up this fact that you could, by adding extra curvature terms to an action with a scalar field, you could get it to bounce. But then if you transform, you conformally transform back to Einstein frame, then the model does not, then in that frame, the model does not appear to bounce, but that would be the frame in which you would actually, that's the frame you would actually care about for computing perturbations for inflation. Is it known in this LQC context whether is there some argument where that to think that the variables which appear to be bouncing here are the variables in the correct frame to draw conclusions about inflation?
Yeah. The bounding occurring really in the physical metric, in the physical FRW metric, I mean, the plane in which in the homogeneous case, the metric is written as minus dt squared plus a squared times the metric of Gaussian curvature. So in that sense, that's a bounding occurring.
As long as you make a homogeneous conformal transformation, that'll be true in any, you know, an Einstein frame or in a non-Einstein frame, but it'll still look like a homogeneous field plus a homogeneous FRW metric, but when you calculate the perturbations, you'll find that.
So then one is looking at perturbations. I should say that perturbations are being looked at very, you know, a lot, but they are not, nothing, I don't know anything that I can say conclusively about them. But as far as the question that you are asking about when you look at the perturbations, then we say that this is really the Einstein thing, the answer is yes.
Okay.
More questions?
Coming back to Layton's first question, about inhomogeneity, is there at least perhaps an argument that the initial period of superinflation might have inflated away some degree of inhomogeneity so that there might be more likelihood that the situation is homogeneous enough for inflation to get started?
I don't see why that would be true, because if the scalar field itself is inhomogeneous, and we assume that sort of some very similar dynamics to the superinflation dynamics we have here goes on, then superinflation itself, the amount of superinflation is going to be inhomogeneous, which means you're going to actually exacerbate the inhomogeneities.
Okay, so it would work to inflate away.
I don't think an argument that simple would work, no. I think there has to be some deeper analysis of what would actually happen for the back reaction of any inhomogeneities. I don't think you could just say that it inflates away, because, again, the amount of superinflation would actually, I think, make problems bigger. I mean, homogeneous, the actual smaller scale inhomogeneities in the smaller region would get increased. So I don't think there's an easy argument there.
I see. Okay, thank you.
I think some of the detailed calculations could be done in the Gaudi model, for example. I mean, of course, perturbation calculations, which we are doing anyway. But if you wanted to have go beyond perturbations, then some detailed calculations could be done in the Gaudi model. I don't know the answer, really.
Okay, well, thank you. I think it would be very interesting to do more of this.
More questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.